This week I'm joined by Richard Kaczynski, who is an American writer and lecturer on the topics of psychology, metaphysics and occultism. We discuss his book, Perdurabo, The Life of Aleister Crowley, alongside discussing Crowley's occult system, Thelema. If you wish to support a Mythics podcast, please find our Patreon, merchandise and donation links in the description below. Enjoy. Okay, Richard Kaczynski, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So before we jump into the Hermetics question, just a very, very brief, because I think a lot of your biography and some of your background might come in later. So just a very quick overview of who you are and where your interests are. And you know, we're talking about your biography of Aleister Crowley called Perdurabo. So a tiny bit of background about that, but I think some of it will come in later. So,
all right. Well, as you indicated, I'm the author of Perdurabo, the biography of Aleister Crowley, and I've also written a couple of other books on this subject, including The Wiser Concise Guide to Aleister Crowley and Forgotten Templars: The Untold Origins of Ordo Templi Orientis, which looks at the history of the organization OTO, which Crowley later became the head of. And this is just a part of an outgrowth of a fascination and that I had with Crowley and just this in general, the subject of Western esotericism my whole life. And it's something that led me to begin exploring and writing about this also as, you know, as a scholarly and academic pursuit. And that's kind of where these books came from.
Because we're going to touch on Thelema, and I know I understand, I hope I'm correct in understanding that you practice Thelema, and that's something that you've been practicing for a long time.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So that will probably come in later when we start talking about what Thelema is and what Crowley was targeting towards. But before anything, the unique question to this podcast, the Hermetics question, which is if you can place three thinkers, living or dead, in a room and listen in on the conversation, who do you pick and why? And you don't have to pick Crowley, by the way. We could almost take that as given if you want.
So it's three hermetic philosophers.
Oh, no, it can be anyone at all.
Just three people at all.
Yeah,
Wow. Let me think about that one. Let me see. Aleister Crowley, Friedrich Nietzsche, and let's say Bertrand Russell. How about that?
Bertrand Russell. So one person in the room is already very, very annoyed, which is Mr. Russell. Mr. Russell. Definitely. Okay, indeed. So Nietzsche and Crowley, there's definitely, because I think I'm right in understanding that Nietzsche was one of the, is it five saints of Thelema?
Well, there's actually a long list of saints in Crowley's Gnostic Mass, but Nietzsche is one of them, and Crowley was, you know, inspired by Nietzsche's writings as well. So it'd be interesting to hear them kind of, you know, chatting away. And and Bertrand Russell, I think, is just kind of for a distaff view of another modern, but, you know, roughly contemporary philosopher.
And an extreme kind of early skeptic, who I don't think...
Yeah.
I wonder, did Russell ever write on... I can't imagine he ever wrote on things such as the occult or magic.
No, but it's interesting in that Crowley did have, I mean, the idea of skepticism also informs Crowley's writings as well. So to see if they found some sort of happy medium there between their disparate views would be kind of interesting.
And Nietzsche, Nietzsche's one of my picks as well. And we've had two other people pick Nietzsche as before. I think, you know, he's someone that, if you're interested in philosophy, he's the absolute personality you'd love to meet. So
yeah. I've often thought, you know, with Nietzsche is that some of the writings he did toward the end of his life are considered a little bit, you know, esoteric and impenetrable, and there's this idea that, you know, he was his sanity was kind of slipping there toward the end, and I've always kind of wondered: is it really a matter of his sanity slipping, or has he just gone like really, really deep into a place where we can't really understand where he's coming from?
And, is that your own personal theory, or
No, I'm not sure. I just remember reading Nietzsche's in my youth and kind of wondering about that, because that kind of resonates with this idea that Crowley has, that once an adept on the path has crossed the abyss, this very big ordeal into this other, sort of existential realm, metaphysically speaking, that you've that the insights one gains are kind of incomprehensible, that one speaks the truth, but echoing across the abyss, is kind of the poetic language, is that these things are perceived as lies. And so the idea that everyone was reading what Nietzsche had to say at the end of his life and going, "What are you talking about?" Kind of, and again, it kind of resonated with that. So it's something I've always wondered about with him.
Okay. Do you think they'd get on? I'm not sure. Nietzsche was extremely shy, and Crowley was perhaps the opposite of extremely shy. So I'm not sure how.
Yeah, but given that Crowley was, an appreciator of Nietzsche, had written in fact, an essay on the Vindication of Nietzsche, that I think that, even if you're shy, if someone's talking to you on your own turf, you're gonna want to talk about the things you care about. So yeah, that would be an interesting combination, I think.
Okay. What do you think they'd talk about?
Well, if Crowley's in the room, we're obviously going to talk about magic, but Crowley's certainly more of an one-trick pony. I mean, one of the things that I find fascinating about him is the fact that there are so many different facets to his character, that not only is he, an occultist, but he's also a mountain climber, and he's also a poet and an author, and various other things. And that I think he'd be pretty able to kind of switch up the conversation and follow wherever the other two wanted to go. And he was certainly an appreciator of philosophy as well. So there's metaphysical philosophy as well as social philosophy and so on. So
So
yeah.
on to your book, Perdurabo, The Life of Aleister Crowley, the definitive biography of the founder of modern magic. And it's now, it seems, at least in my kind of research into this, it's considered by students of Thelema and occultists and anyone who's looking into the occult as the definitive biography of Crowley. It's there is others, there's the Eye in the Triangle, and there's a couple of others, but I remember seeming that they were coming from a very clear bias. And yours was extremely factual, extremely well written, and it flowed extremely well. I read it very,
Well,
very
thank you.
quickly. The question there is, what was the research like on this? Because I remember when I was reading it, it's kind of checking the sources here, and a lot were from Crowley's confessions. But what was the research process like? And how did you go about that?
Yes. Well, first of all, I think it's interesting that you point out that some of the earlier biographies clearly had a bias, either pro or against, and that, to me, was one of the things that actually motivated me to write the book. That, using, for example, Eye as a Triangle as an example, that almost seemed to be overly apologetic. And obviously, books like Simon's The Great Beast were very hostile, and I found both of those approaches to be kind of bothersome, because to me, I heard the narrator basically telling me what to think of Crowley, and I had, read enough of his writings to have my own opinions. So I, again, the idea that the author was trying to tell me what to think was annoying, and so I wanted to tell the story again just from a very factual basis and try and keep my opinion out of it and let people decide for themselves. Do I think he's really cool? Do I think he's horrible? Do I think he's interesting, or what? And draw their own conclusions. And for a fair bit of his biography, one would have to rely on his autobiography, The Confessions. But those only go up to, they leave out the last 25 years of his life, basically. And so there's a lot of filling in to do, and obviously there's a lot of verifying what was in his confessions. And originally, the first draft, or the first version, the public edition of Perdurabo, was done a really old school way. This was A lot of the research was done pre-internet, and it was essentially going through the material that I had, the books and stuff I had been reading about Crowley, and identifying just the names of people that he mentioned or that he knew either in his diaries or in his other writings, and going to the, there's this big catalog, I mean, multi-volume list called the National Union Catalog of Manuscript Collections, and looking up these like 700 names, you know, to see if any of them had archives or anything like that, you know, manuscript collections anywhere in the world, and writing to all of those who did. And, you know, most of those 700 people didn't, but through this process, writing to different universities and research libraries around the world, finding, you know, letters and manuscripts and other material from Crowley and these tucked away in these little collections that no one had ever looked at before, as well as visiting the main archives of his, you know, surviving manuscript papers, you know, including the Warburg Institute, you know, in London, and the University of Texas and Austin, and various others salted about, and just trying to put things together in a coherent sort of chronological timeline. A lot of these stories about Crowley are kind of like overlapping episodes. And for me, what was kind of interesting is how these, some of these things coincided and lined up chronologically. So kind of teasing that apart and trying to put it, you know, together into a straightforward narrative was, yeah, my goal.
Mm-hmm. And was there anything there, considering Crowley's kind of hectic, eclectic, and to many people, insane life? You know, this isn't a biography of someone who, it's just, so for instance, at the moment I'm reading the biography of Immanuel Kant, and this is a biography for the sake of, well, he wrote these interesting books, so let's see what happened. Crowley's life itself is a work of art. You know, he wrote all these things, he created this religion, he wrote tons and tons of books, but at the same time, what's happening in his life is borderline mad. So was there anything, considering this, was there anything you didn't expect to find?
Having read as much as I had, you know, by the time, you know, I started working on this, I knew the large details pretty well. But if I'm thinking about things, I think one of the things that really struck me is the things that people tended to gloss over, you know, in previous biographies. And one of those to me was his considerable career as a mountain climber, and that, you know, he actually did set, you know, a number of world records for ascents, maybe not successful attempts, such as climbing K2. That was ultimately foiled due to bad weather, but the climbers on that expedition had set a record for living at a higher altitude for a longer period of time than it ever happened. And no one had ever climbed higher on K2 for about 50 years. And by that point, the sorts of equipment that were available to climbers were far more sophisticated than what, you know, Crowley and his colleagues had on those climbs. So, you know, those sorts of accomplishments that tend to get glossed over, I thought were very interesting. People seem to want to focus on all the, you know, forget previous biographers wanted to focus on the, you know, the sensational and the tawdry bits. And again, I find that there's a more complete tale to be told there, you know. And, you know, I think if you go through anybody's life, you can find times in their life where they messed up or they behaved in an unseemly way, and to focus on that would be a you know, a distorted biography of anybody. So I kind of wanted to go into all the details until, you know, the whole thing, including the things that people thought were dull, because I'm climbing mountains, that's, to me, that's not dull at all.
Yeah, when I was thinking about this interview today, I remember emailing you the questions and then a few bits of biography that I kind of would love to touch on because they were, like, you know, so interesting. And I thought to myself, bugger, I left out the K2 bit, which Crowley has this childhood, which has a few strange moments where this kind of a bomb goes off in his garden and he's blind, which gives him this strange connection with his senses. And then I can't remember, not too much happens. I mean, it's Crowley, so probably quite a few bits happen, but nothing too much merit. And then he starts, I mean, he's quite young when he's doing this, the mountain stuff, because he also, if my memory is correct, he invented a form of mountain climbing, which wasn't popular for very long, but it was kind of sea mountain climbing, but it was extremely popular for a few years.
Yeah, I don't think you could say that he so much invented it, but he was, he was kind of there, when it became popular, and it was, the bouldering and the sea cliff climbing, chalk cliffs like Beachy Head is kind of the famous ascent of his that he and his cousin did when they were still in their teens, and one of their climbs actually got stuck up there and had to be rescued, but. Climbing for him was originally part of a rest cure. He had a life-threatening illness as a child, and getting out to the country and getting involved in some kind of physical activity was part of his recuperation, and he found that it was a thing that he loved doing, and he continued doing it into his early adulthood. And it wasn't until the disaster that happened on Kanchenjunga that he never went back to that again. That was kind of the end of it for him.
Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just that he mountain climbed. He was, I think I'm right in saying that when they ventured up K2 50 years later. So I can't remember what year it was when Crowley ventured up.
About 1902.
So when you're reading this, it's hard to think, okay, like it's hard to kind of gauge it. But when they went back 50 years later, I think I'm right in saying that they actually used long sections, if not all, of Crowley's routes. So he was naturally talented enough of a mountain climber to be able to pick out routes. But at the same time, what this shows, I think, which was important in the book, is that Crowley's kind of persona and charisma and the reasons that he's popular and known, as the wickedest man in the world, etc. These weren't things which he attached and created just for the... to have alongside the magic. This is someone who is almost madly courageous enough in 1902 to venture up K2. That takes a certain kind of insanity in a way.
And I guess that's something that would be shared by all of his compatriots who are trying to do that as well. It's kind of interesting that we read now that with global warming there's a lot of these areas on these mountains like the Himalayas where the snow is melting. We're finding the bodies of climbers who had died before, and there was an avalanche on the Kanchenjunga expedition I think in 1905. Mm-hmm. And that whole experience really kind of was something that Crowley never kind of got over. It just all went really badly, and that was kind of the end of the sport for him.
So he never climbed after that?
Not as such. I mean, he might have, climbed the hills here or there, like in Chefalu or whatever, in the 20s. But as in terms of big climbs, mm-hmm. that was the end of it for him. He sometimes referred to having when he had bouts of asthma, which apparently is something that's very common amongst people who do mountain climbing, because those altitudes are kind of high on or hard on the lungs. That when he had really bad bouts of that, he would refer to it as Kanchenjunga fever or something like that. But it was just those memories of that really bad climb were kind of coming back to him.
Flashbacks to a crazy expedition. Yeah. So you mentioned earlier about how the earlier biographies, The Great Beast, The Eye in the Triangle, were all kind of saying, look, here's what happened and here's how you should think about it. And you said, you've written Perdurabo as setting down the facts, and it does, and I agree with what you've said, that you read it in such a way that you're allowing the reader to make their own decisions. I've got the revised edition, so there's a lot of extra detail, but there's so much detail in some bits where you kind of, you add in some detail which could sway you one way, but then you also say, well, hang on, this also happened. So what my question is, because I found it difficult to gain a very clear one. What was your personal impression of Crowley that you gathered? What do you think he was like in a day-to-day sense, just as a, I don't want to say ordinary person, but that wouldn't be strictly true.
Yeah, I think it depends on the nature of your relationship with Crowley. I think that's the thing that I take away from this. And a good example of this, I think, is the relationship that he had with Gerald York, who originally came on as one of his students and later kind of broke with Crowley, you know, or not so much broke with him, but basically concluded that he could not continue being a student of Crowley's, but nevertheless was still remained a friend of his, and not only was a friend, but also a benefactor who helped with some of his publishing projects. And when Crowley died, was one of the, you know, was the main person to collect together his archives and remaining literary papers. And those are, it's this collection which is the big collection in the world at the Warburg Institute in London. So despite no longer being a student of Crowley's, he was still very much someone who believed that Crowley had something important to say and that it was worth preserving and for people listening to it. But the reason I tell this story is that they went through a very contentious period at one point where Crowley was constantly beating up on Gerald York, saying that he wasn't doing enough to promote the great work, the spreading of his message of Thelema and magic and so on. And Gerald York was someone who came from a family of means. And in Crowley's mind, if you had means, you should liquidate those and put all those toward promulgating the law of Thelema, which is basically what Crowley did. He had inherited a fortune, and he spent basically all of it self-publishing his books, and in many cases selling them, such as his books on magic, for instance. He tended to want to sell at cost so he could not be accused of profiting on magic. But what wound up happening is he blew through his inheritance rather quickly. And Gerald York was not willing to follow that model. And it wasn't until they really had it out and it got really ugly. And then Crowley realized that, oh, wait, you don't want to be a student anymore. You just want to be just a regular guy. Okay, I misunderstood. You know, I was giving you the ordeals that the master would give to a student. But if you're just some other dude, then okay, let's you know, I'll treat you accordingly. And so I think that's, you know, the point. Now, how Crowley would treat you would depend on whether you were a student or not. And it seemed like with his students, he could be quite demanding and harsh. I think in Crowley's mind, he was the message. And so promulgating the law of Thelema or doing the great work meant promoting Crowley. And you were expected to do that. And whether that meant, you know, helping with publishing his next book, or whether it meant making monthly contributions toward his living expenses, was all kind of the one big thing, because he was the prophet of Thelema. And even though Crowley could, you know, he could keep those accounts separate, you know, money for books versus money for living, you know, it was still all part of the great work. But if you're just a friend, he could be a charming, personable sort of person. And it also seems there's some people who got him, and those who got him were lifelong friends. Lewis Wilkinson was a lifelong friend of Crowley's. Gerald York was another. Carl Germer, who was Crowley's successor in Ordo Templi Orientis, as the head of the organization, was also a lifelong friend of Crowley's. And there are those people who just never quite got along, and they had this horrible opinion. So it's just like you've got this love-hate thing going on. You either love him or you hate him. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of middle ground when it comes to Crowley.
If he was to meet you, you think you'd get along?
Gosh, I would hope so. You know, again, I would expect Crowley to kind of be tough, but I hope he would at least he would appreciate what I had to say about him and try to get his point of view across. You know, I'm kind of reminded of what the people used to say when the biography of Jim Morrison, No One Here Gets Out Alive, came out. And it was I think it was in Rolling Stone, for instance, they talked about, you know, Jim Morrison was kind of this crazy, almost scary sort of front man for the Doors, that he was, you know, brilliant and a poetic and a performer and charismatic, but he was also kind of crazy and dangerous. And, you know, now that he is safely dead, we can, you know, tell his story, and it's a story that we can we can embrace now that there's enough time and distance between us and this sort of wild and uncontrollable force of nature. And I kind of think of Crowley sometimes in those terms. You know, I don't know that. I don't know. I honestly couldn't guess how we would get along.
But, you wouldn't want to write a biography while he's alive.
Yeah. In fact, I've been approached about, now that you've written the story of Crowley, you should write about what happened with Ordo Templi Orientis after he died. Now it's like, oh, that is such a hot potato. There's so many of those people who are still alive who know so much, who are there, and therefore know more. But at the same time, there are people that have very, very different versions of what happened.
Yeah. It does seem that way.
So instead, I went and I wrote the prequel of what happened before Crowley came into Ontario, or everyone what happened afterwards.
Yeah, and very, very quickly, kind of. And that was the end, and we went. I've had John Michael Guerra on this podcast. I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work. Yeah, he's not a big fan of Crowley. He's said this very clearly. But one of the things he said, and this is actually to do with what happened after Crowley's death, is that the only reason Thelema ever became big isn't anything really to do with Crowley. It's all to do with Grady McMurtry. And do you see any truth in that at all?
Well, I think there is more to that story, and it's not. To attribute that all to Grady McMurtry, I think, is a little bit of a disservice to some other key players in that story. And it's true to say that in Crowley's lifetime, particularly at the time that he died, the only active body of Ordo Templi Orientis, this group that he threw himself into, the only active body was in Southern California. That's the group that Grady McMurtry and various others belonged to. So it wasn't like he was, at the end of his life, the leader of this big movement. And it wasn't until the 60s that there was this interest in alternative spiritualities, whether it be transcendental meditation or what have you, that the name of Aleister Crowley turns up again, and gets, he turns up on the cover of Let It Be, and that he becomes a subject of some fascination for Jimmy Page, Led Zeppelin, and so there's this whole pop culture sort of shift that happens, and there's just this whole birth of a new age movement, and the publication of Crowley's Thoth Tarot in the early 70s, all these things start to open up this interest in Crowley in a way that wasn't the case before. And part of that is due to the fact that after Crowley died, there's a small and dedicated group of, I don't want to call them followers, because they weren't all followers. There was, for instance, Gerald York was part of that. And again, he was no longer a follower, but he was still very actively trying to preserve Crowley's literary corpus. And he was doing that in the UK. Carl Germer, Crowley's successor, was doing that in the U.S., and there were a couple of others, like a handful of collectors around the world who were trying very hard to track down Crowley's pieces, and they were sharing, mimeographs and carbon copies of things with each other, trying to make sure that, there were multiple copies of these things around in the case of, some sort of disaster. And so there, I think that is a big piece of it, because what we know about Crowley survives in these archives that these people put together. Yeah. And they, again, they survive at places like the Warburg Institute and the Harry Ransom Center in Austin, Texas. But in terms of the magical activity, it was Grady McMurtry who revived Ordo Templi Orientis. The organization went through a rather fallow period, and it was after Carl Germer died. And there was, for several years, no activity. And even the other members didn't really know about this, because the group had become so moribund. And that's, Grady McMurtry, who was given this authority to take control of the order in California. There's this crazy stuff that was going on in Crowley's lifetime. And Crowley met Grady as a military person right after the war, the World War II, and he was stationed in London, and said, "I don't know what's going on back there in California, but I'm, giving you these powers to go back there, see what's going on, and if things are really bad, just take over and kind of put things back in order." And these were supposedly these powers were subject to the approval of Carl Germer. Well, here we are. It's the late 60s, early 70s. Carl Germer is dead. The situation in California is certainly an emergency at this point. And, you know, Grady McMurtry, 30 years later, uses these powers to try to restart the order. And he, in doing this, he contacted all the other people who were active in Crowley's lifetime, and they all pulled together and got it going again. And the organization is functioning to this day, and, you know, worldwide is looking, you know, has roughly 3,000 members, I believe. So it's certainly more active and larger as a movement than it was at the end of Crowley's lifetime. And certainly, you know, OTO is not the only philamic organization out there. So there's a lot of other groups that are either based around or at least draw some inspiration from Crowley's writings. And so the number of people who are some sort of practicing occultist that draws on Crowley is far larger than, you know, the number of people in Ordo Templi Orientis. So it's, yeah, he's certainly far more popular today than he was then. And Grady McMurtry was a big piece of it, but not the only piece.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you say about it being far more popular today. I was hoping to find a way to ask you this, and there's my chance. I'm not sure if you've watched the Strange Angels series about Jack Parsons.
Yes.
So obviously that's kind of thrown Crowley and Thelema and Jack Parsons' story. For anyone who doesn't know, Jack Parsons was a student of Thelema in the
40s and 50s.
Wrote his own book, which is very good. Was a rocket scientist. But he had an extremely interesting life story. But anyway, the point of it is that his biography, The Strange Angel, is now a hit NBC show, which for me was surprising because it's Thelema and it's Crowley and it's on mainstream TV. But, Richard, does this give across a correct impression of what Thelema and Crowley is like? Or is this buying into the wickedest man in the world shtick?
I don't know that so much buys into the wickedest man in the world shtick, but it is not an accurate representation of Thelema or the way Ordo Templi Orientis worked. The series Strange Angel is a fictionalized account. It's based on Jack Parsons. There's a lot of things about the show that are not historically accurate. And Thelema is not the only, you know, the representation of Thelema is not the only one. I mean, the way they tell the story, there are these elements where the head of the lodge engaging in all sorts of interference and manipulations in people's private lives. I mean, that kind of stuff wasn't going on. The sorts of events they show happening in ceremonies, I think that was all kind of sensationalized for television. Basically the whole second season, I remember watching it I think as entertainment and as an interesting TV drama, I think the show was interesting and enjoyable, and it was fun for me to hear quotes of passages from Crowley's writings regularly being spoken in this show. But at the same time, it is not history, and it's not, you know, it shouldn't be taken as such. I think one of the things I find most objectionable about the show is kind of the way they try to interconnect things that give a false impression not only of Thelema but also the history of rocketry and the history of, you know, which is therefore the history of science.
Such as?
There's a scene where, you know, Jack Parsons solves the problem of coming up with a stable rocket fuel, and the problem he was having is that the solid fuels that he was using, you know, again, as I understand this, I'm not a rocket scientist, but the fuel that would be subject to air pockets and things like that would not burn evenly, and that caused problems in getting consistent thrust. And he was trying to figure out some way of having a solid substance that behaved more like a liquid. And he realized that something akin to tar was the answer. And that, in fact, did prove to be the solution to the problem of getting a working rocket. in the TV show, they have this scene where he's very frustrated and he's burning his magical journals, and sheets of paper blow away and land on his roof and start a fire. And it's kind of like saying, because he burnt these magical journals, he had this breakthrough in his figuring out rocket fuel, and that's not how it happened at all. But so it's kind of like, here's this important moment in the history of rocket science that is being misrepresented, So I kind of feel that the story of Jack Parsons is pretty astonishing as is, and didn't need these sorts of dramatic flourishes to make it more interesting. But apparently, when you try to get the rights to these sorts of things, and you're dealing with real people and people's estates and all of that, if you don't get the necessary permissions, you kind of got to work around those things. And I know that you're making a show for television, and so it's not going to be textbook history. So you kind of take it all with a grain of salt.
Yeah. Returning back to Crowley and his biography, obviously we can't go over. There's bits I wanted to discuss, of course. There's a fantastic court case which I'd love to discuss, but I can't. The court case is hilarious, but I don't think.
Yes.
Oh, we probably should discuss it. It is fantastic.
Oh, I love the court case.
So this is the two founders of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which is still going strong, I believe, in some form or other.
Yes.
Take Aleister Crowley to court for releasing all the secret magic and the secret rituals. And the transcripts of the court are interspersed very tongue-in-cheek by yourself, Richard, with constant kind of reminders that the audience of the jury is kind of laughing at these. It's a kind of absurd, strange happening. But yeah, perhaps you can expand on it, because...
Yeah. Well, the fascination they have with these court proceedings is that through the transcripts, and when there aren't transcripts or survivors, at least a lot of press coverage, that it's really possible to reconstruct this testimony. And so you get to hear things that were actually said in court. So I know for me, that's interesting. Not only do we have things that Crowley actually said preserved, but there's also just this, what the hell sort of feeling of, this is actually a court case. Oh my gosh, I don't believe this. And yeah. So both of those things to me are kind of fascinating. So I put a lot of work into trying to reconstruct the testimony, not only of that case, but the court case 20 years later, the Black Magic libel suit. And I just love reading that stuff. I wound up, despite kind of reconstructing large swaths of that, I wound up editing it down for publication ultimately, because that section did not match the pace of the rest of the book. And I later released, kind of the longer versions and something I called Perturabo Outtakes. But the one case that you're talking about involved Crowley with his publication, The Equinox, including the rituals of the Golden Dawn. And there was a injunction was filed trying to stop the publication of the third issue, which was going to be the Golden Dawn's inner order rituals, the extra special secret ones. And when this went to court, it was covered in the press and was quite spectacular. And part of the issue was that MacGregor Mathers was claiming that he was the sole and supreme head of the Rosicrucian order, and therefore these rituals were his property. And he ran into a couple of problems there. One is that there were a lot of other people who thought that they were ahead of their own version of the Rosicrucian order, which suddenly put Mavers on the bad side of all these other people, and suddenly, it's again, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so they were kind of on Crowley's side when he won. There's also the idea that, it is the nature of ritual that, you borrow. And Crowley did this, the Golden Dawn did this. If you need a lovely an invocation or an inspiring passage to read, you don't reinvent the wheel. You quote from some other source. That source may be the Bible, it may be the Chaldean oracles, it may be some excellent poetry by Shelley or Keats or something like that. But if someone else said it better, then you use that. And that is, in many cases, present in the Golden Dawn's rituals. And the judge who was reading these recognized enough passages that were lifted from other places. And again, I don't mean that in a judgmental way, but seeing that this, you know, the source material for these, where these rituals came from other places, the judge basically ruled that, no, you don't, these are not your rituals. These are kind of pieced together from other places. And therefore, the judge allowed Croy to proceed with the publication. You know, and I don't know, and in this world of, you know, sampling and remixes and things like that, you know, one wonders, you know, to what extent, you know, cut up literature or the putting together pieces into a unique structure, you know, is actually a creative act. But in this case, the judge did not support that idea, and you know, the rest is history.
And leading up to this court case, I kind of remember that Crowley believed he was being attacked by McGregor. Kind of his horse-drawn carriage caught on fire, and lots of other little things were happening to him, and it was a it's kind of an extremely paranoid few weeks, I believe, for Crowley.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a few places where they were were not getting along, you know, and this was certainly one of them. It was essentially the end game there, had their final falling out.
Yeah. So the next little bit of biography is my favorite bit of the biography, just without a doubt. And a lot of people say, there's a section in this book and I couldn't put it down. This is one of the times for me, and I've read a lot now, where this was...
Ooh, I can't wait.
absolutely true. I mean, I literally couldn't put it down. I think it was about 1:30 in the morning and I had to be up for work. But I was like, no. I need to read about Crowley's battle with Trebizond in the desert. That is what's happening right now. Newberg, Crowley, and I believe it's Guardian of Hell. I believe it's...
The Demon of Dispersion.
Demon of Dispersion. 333.
Yes.
In the desert. So yeah, can you talk us through this? What is probably my favorite occult moment of all time?
I always thought this is like the made for film sort of moment as well. It would be how you would do it, I'm not quite sure, but it would be great. But this is based on the Enochian system of the Elizabethan magus John Dee, and put together with Edward Kelly, his partner in these scryings with the Enochian, you know, with the angels essentially, and these angels communicated to them the language, which they're a language which they called Enochian, and a series of invocations for the 30 ethers, the different, you know, the different layers of reality or of the universe or so on. And while there's a whole system of Enochian magic out there, there's much more than just these 30 calls, Crowley thought it would be interesting experiment to recite each of these 30 ethers, you know, the calls of the 30 ethers, and do an astral vision for each of them and try to see what, you know, what could be gleaned from that. And this was done as an exercise while Crowley and Neuberg were on a walking holiday through Algeria. And so they're walking through the desert and they would stop at various points, and what would happen is they would intone or recite the corresponding key that they were doing that, and the call they were doing for that day. And Crowley would try to go into a trance state and look at this crystal that he brought with him, and you know, Victor would act as the scribe, writing down what Crowley said. This went on, you know, again, for a better part of a month. They walked several hundred kilometers, basically, in the course of this holiday over 30 days, while also doing this magic. And when they got, and they worked their way backwards from 30 up to 10, 10 was the ether that John Dee, in his diary, said was accursed and was guarded by the demon Trebizond, the demon of dispersion. And so what winds up happening in this magical working or psychodrama or what have you is that when Crowley starts to do his vision, something weird happens, and you know, it's not clear whether, because you know, again, you've got the scribe's account of what is happening, and apparently Crowley, or the demon Karanzan, appears taking on the form of Crowley, begins to taunt and torment, you know, poor Victor with his foibles and past experiences, and actually changes shape into other people from Neuberg's past, and is trying to convince him to, you know, cross the circle so that the spirit can escape and things like that. And it's quite a dramatic and harrowing bit of drama. And then at one point, you know, there's groans on his belly, I'll you know, tear open your innards, and I'll floss my teeth with your intestines and stuff like that. And apparently leaps on him and tries to tear his throat out, and Victor, for, you know, his magical defenses, wards the demon off and escapes. But it's some pretty dramatic stuff, yeah.
Which leads,
I don't think I quite did it justice, but it's
like you said, even if you were to film it, or it's very difficult. You know, it's done extremely well in the book, but obviously that's a lot of thoughts gone into that. It's extremely difficult to articulate what it is about it that's so pressured and strange.
And that is one of the things about ritual. There have been films done of, or you know, just movies or just video shot of various rituals, and seeing them from the outside, or it's not the same as being present in that moment. Any ceremony, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're watching, you know, mass for shut-ins or what have you, watching a ritual from the outside is just not the same as being in it. So I think it would be pretty difficult to capture the spirit of that if you were actually in that moment.
Before we slide into the Book of the Law, which is, I think, probably the most important part of Crowley's biography, which will lead us into Thelema, there's just one more question about Crowley himself, which is kind of a, as you're someone who practices Thelema and practices the occult, I'm not sure if you're fond of the word occult. I know some people aren't. Do you think Crowley was a good occultist, an adept, and an accomplished occultist?
Yes, I do. He certainly had many, many years of experience. The things that he writes, I think, speak for themselves, and the system that he promotes, I think, is a very good one. You know, there's the, you know, the idea of, you know, I find that magic is a great way of mastering discipline. Because when you're doing magic, it really requires you to do exercises on, you know, on a regular routine, and keep records of that. And if you're doing, you know, particular ritual, you're doing it on a particular day at a particular time. And there's a lot of, again, I guess discipline is really the word for it, to be, you know, successful at this, in much in the same way that discipline is required to be successful as a musician or anything else. And you know, one could ask, you know, was I drawn to this because I liked I already was a disciplined and intellectually minded person, and therefore it suited me, or did it you know, bring out, or did it instill those qualities in me? I the more I think about it, the more I think I go with the latter, that I just kind of found the thing that suits me personally. But yeah, I find a lot of wisdom and insight in not only his writings, but just the system that he put together and put out there.
The kind of final big bit of biography that I'll to expand on here, which is the system of Thelema, to give a metaphor which isn't meant to offend anyone, but it's the clearest, the Bible of Thelema is the Book of the Law. Does it have a Liber? Is it just the Book of the Law? Is that the full title?
I mean, there's also a Latin title, the Liber title. It's, you know, Liber al Valdecus.
Okay. Yeah. So this is recounted, spoken to Crowley. I guess the only way you can really put it to people who aren't into this kind of thing is, you know, in his mind, when he is in Egypt. He goes somewhere specific in Egypt and this happens. I can't remember what he's visiting.
Well, he was in Cairo at the time. This was part of his honeymoon excursion. And his new wife has gone into this peculiar sort of trance state and told him that the gods of Egypt, you know, have a message for him. And, you know, that the whole setup to that is a long story in and of itself. But, you know, the short version of it is that, convinced that this is a genuine message, Crowley's wife Rose instructs him to go into the study of this flat that they were renting at noon on three successive days and to write down what he hears, and thus he does, and receives the three chapters of the Book of the Law. And each of the three chapters represents a different personage speaking to him about the universe, or how that personage, you know, sees the universe and communicating, you know, mysteries to Crowley. And so the first chapter is speaking from the standpoint of Nuit, the star goddess, representing, you know, the infinite possibility. The second chapter is spoken by Hadith, the finite, the point, the manifestation of the single possibility, I suppose, is one way you could look at it. And then the third chapter is spoken by Rehor Kwit, the child of Horus and Isis. I'm sorry, of Isis and Osiris in Egyptian mythology, and typifies not only the eon of the child, which Crowley says is the eon that we are in, but that Rehor Kwit or Horus has a martial or warlike nature, and that kind of creeps out in that third chapter as well. And so you've got these three kind of transmissions that make up the Book of the Law.
Okay, and the Book of the Law is, do you think this encapsulates the whole system, or was anything he wrote about the system afterwards kind of made to just articulate it a bit clearer? Because the Book of the Law is extremely cryptic.
Yes, it is. And Crowley certainly encouraged people to form their own interpretation of that cryptic text, but he also wrote commentaries that tried to elaborate, you know, his understanding of the text. And so I think the text should be read in conjunction with his commentaries. But while that's certainly the cornerstone of Crowley's system, there's other places that very much elaborate the philosophy and the cosmology of Crowley's belief system. The visions they obtained in Algeria doing the Enochian calls, for instance, is a very important piece of that as well. So it's approaching Crowley's works as kind of stepping into a universe of itself. There's an elephant to eat, basically. Then you just, you know, have to eat it a bite at a time. It takes kind of a little while to get familiar enough with all the literature to see how the pieces interconnect. And that's even though the basic message itself is pretty simple and clear. It's just that there's all sorts of nuance and elaboration.
So how can you kind of sum up or approach Thelema, considering that this, the Book of the Law, this extremely cryptic text, is the one that, you know, Crowley says, I think, multiple times, you know, if you want to understand Thelema, you need to understand the Book of the Law. And so how do you approach it, and how do you kind of sum up Thelema?
Well, Crowley would open every single letter he wrote, and he would greet people with the phrase from the Book of the Law, "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law." And that one sentence, in his mind, seemed to sum up, you know, the essence of the philosophy. And, you know, again, while Crowley encouraged everyone to study this and kind of come up with their own interpretation, I will hazard a paraphrase of the sorts of things that Crowley said about this. And the idea is that each of us in our lifetimes here on this earth has, you know, plays a part in the machine of the universe. We have a nature that suits, that uniquely is as our own. And through the process of, and the discipline of magic, and the keeping of a journal, and the introspection and the meditation and all that is part of it, we come to learn our inner nature better. And once we're better in touch and we understand our inner nature, we can be true to it and act in accordance with that nature and our role in the universe. And that's not, you know, are terribly different from things you might hear in some other spiritual disciplines. You know, in Christianity, they might say, you know, you found your calling. You know, and in Philemon said, we have discovered our true will. The thing that Crowley says is, you know, essentially, so our goal here and our incarnation is to discover our will. Why are we here? What are we here to do? You know, what is our true nature? And then to act in accordance with it. And the phrase, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, really is not a libertine sort of do whatever you want to do sort of thing, which many people have misunderstood, but it's really saying, find out why you're here and do that and nothing else. If you're here for a reason, then everything you do in this incarnation needs to further that purpose.
So the extremely difficult question, I'm sure this is going to frustrate you, how do we go about finding out our true will?
I think that's where the magic comes in. That's through that, because magic ultimately is inner work. It's work in ourselves. And while you can do magic to try and affect change in the outside world, you know, there's this idea of high magic, the idea that we are working on ourselves, that we're trying to make, you know, we're trying to learn about ourselves, to explore our own potentiality. I think of something that one of my colleagues, the author Alain Duquette, says, is that doing magic doesn't make us superhuman, it makes us extra human. And that's what we're working on. We're working on making ourselves extra human. And through that process, we discover ourselves, and we discover, you know, what our role in this incarnation is. We find our place in the universe, and then we go out and do it.
That's a good overview. I mean, how then can we how can we approach Thelema today then? I mean, where would you know, I'm not advocating, I'm not saying any for or against, I'm going to remain unbiased, but if someone was interested, where would you recommend they begin? Other than Perdurabo, of course.
Well, Perdurabo is a great way to understand who Crowley was, but you know, it's not necessarily a guide to how to, you know, what to, it's not a guide to what is Thelema, how to practice it. Now, it turns out that I do have a book out called The Wiser Concise Guide to Aleister Crowley, which is a really short 128-page volume that not only talks about Crowley's life, but also talks about the organizations that he led in his lifetime, which are the Ordo Templi Orientis, which we've spoken about. There's the kind of the more Golden Dawn style initiation society called the AA, and then there's the more religious arm of all of that called the Gnostic Catholic Church. But then it also, the book also goes and talks about various practices that are part of Crowley's magical instructions, and that's a pretty good place to get an overview. If we're looking at some other books on the subject, I could also mention Lon Milo Duquette has a book called The Magic of Aleister Crowley, which presents, again, a chapter on each of Crowley's main rituals with instructions on how to perform them and how to do them. And there are a number of books out there by other Thelemic authors. There's Colin Campbell has a book on Thelema. There's David Shoemaker has one called Living Thelema. Rodney Orpheus has a book called Abrahadabra. And all of those are also really good introductory texts to that. Other than reading books and kind of taking your practice from that is, get out there and meet some people who are practicing. You know, there are communities of Thelemites out there who love nothing better than to sit around and geek out about magic and what they're doing and talk about Aleister Crowley. I think, you know, the only word of caution is that, you know, to quote another passage in the Book of the Law, which is the law is for all. But I think we can follow that up by saying, even though the law of Thelema is for everybody, every group out there is not right for everyone else. So, you know, the first group of people you encounter, you know, again, we're are going to be reflections of the people that are part of that group. And, you know, that chemistry may not be right, or a particular group may not be right. And, you know, if you're interested in Thelema and you go to a meetup somewhere and you don't particularly like that group of people, you know, keep trying, you know, until you found the people that hit that sweet spot for you. Okay. But, you know, there's something really great about finding a group of like-minded people, because it's a way of getting, you know, not only the voice of experience, but you also get into the benefit of encouragement and social support. You know, it's a thing that like recharges your batteries, because a lot of this magic stuff is solitary. You're doing it by yourself at home in privacy, because again, it's your own internal work. But to have, you know, fellowship with other people who are on the same path just has this way of, you know, recharging your batteries, encouraging you to kind of, you know, go back and do your solitary work, you know.
Okay. I think that's a good overview. Is there anything you'd like to add about Crowley or Thelema that we've missed that you feel is important?
Oh gosh, I could talk about this stuff all day, but I don't know. How about you? Is there anything you feel we've...
Well, you know, one of the things I think that's been good so far is that we haven't really touched on too many of the sensational aspects. Because people, you know, one of the questions I had here is that when people think of Crowley, is they think of the you know, that tagline that I've already said, which is the wickedest man in the world. And there certainly is multiple times in Perdurabo where you think, okay, I can understand. So we've got the Abbey of Thelema, which was filled to the brim with drugs. We've got supposed orgies, we've got sacrifice of animals, and we've got all these things, but I'm not sure. I think you've made it clear that the truth of these happenings is fairly grey.
Yes. And I would further say that there's this perception that Crowley liked any publicity, even if it was bad publicity, and that's not true at all. And these headlines, particularly from the Cefalù period, when he was out of the country and essentially broke, so we were going to have the ability to travel around, let alone, you know, hire an attorney and sue people. He was very frustrated, you know, by all these negative headlines, and so the wickedest man in the world was not a title that he either chose or claimed with any pride. There was when he was actually able to finally get back to London and hook up with a publisher of the Mandrake Press. You know, they went to great pains to put out a book called The Legend of Aleister Crowley that tried to address and dispel this negative perception that the press had produced. And even under Grady McMurtry, there was, you know, he was promoting this, you know, during Crowley's lifetime, this Clear Crowley's Name campaign. But on balance, I am also reminded of something that Gerald York once said to Crowley about this, and that certainly defend yourself and clear the air, but you know, be careful not to whitewash yourself, because I think he said somewhere a whitewashed beast is no good at all. So there is something about Crowley that really is sticking his eye into, or sticking his finger, poking his finger in the eye of, you know, Victorian sensibilities or Edwardian sensibilities, and, you know, calling out the bullshit and hypocrisy of our society. And so he was very much that antagonist, but not in the way that he was frequently portrayed in the press. You know, the whole, you know, the drug thing is another one of those issues that's been wildly exaggerated. You know, this idea that Crowley was a lifelong heroin addict, and, you know, toward the end of his life he took enough heroin to kill a whole room of people is something that Simons wrote in his book. And, you know, the fact of the matter is far more prosaic. You know, Crowley was, you know, as I mentioned earlier in this interview, he came down with asthma, presumably as a result of his mountain climbing. But regardless, he came down with severe asthma around the age of, let's see, 45, and a physician prescribed heroin to him for its analgesic properties. A couple of years later, the Dangerous Drug Act was passed, and heroin became unavailable. But unfortunately, at that time, Crowley was hooked, and he went through a couple of years, literally in just, you know, 2 or 3 years, where he was, living in Chefalu and buying this stuff, on the black market until finally ran out of money and, against his will, essentially went cold turkey. And not until his late 60s again, when, he was taking other asthmatic medicines and they stopped working. This has been in the 40s now, we're talking 1940s, that heroin again became available to physicians as a prescription drug, and his physician put him back on that to manage his asthma symptoms. So, this whole Crowley and heroin story really is kind of an exaggeration. It was medicine he was taking for asthma, which isn't to say that Crowley did not, indulge in drugs and explore entheogens as a possible path for spiritual work, but at the same time, the legend and the truth are quite different.
Yeah, and I think that seems to be what Perdurabo's aim is kind of presenting everything and saying, well, here you go, you decide. I'm not sure how helpful the popular impression of Crowley really is. Yeah, it takes away all the nuance and
Yeah, the only thing one could say is perhaps the popular impression perhaps kept his legend alive long enough for more balanced scholarship to come along and put a story out there in a more balanced light.
Yeah. So yeah, is there anything you're currently working on that you'd like to talk about, or what are your latest projects?
Well, I just recently put out a book called Panic in Detroit, which is looking at specifically this period in Detroit where Crowley was trying to start Ordo Templi Orientis in the United States, particularly in Detroit. And while that didn't quite happen, we were talking about the press impression of Crowley, and there was a moral panic that broke out in the press around Crowley's time in Detroit. And so this book basically is just a real deep dive into this one period of Crowley's life. I'm originally from the Detroit area, so this is a period that's also of particular interest to me. Another book I'm currently working on, well, two other things I can mention. One is that in addition of one of Crowley's books of poetry and essays, his first such collection called The Sword of Song, will be coming out this spring from Camuret Press in the UK. And the thing that makes this collection, or this particular edition, kind of neat is that it's really the first time that this volume has been reprinted since it was first published in 1904. And there's not only am I adding a long introduction to it, but there's a lot of endnotes, this editorial apparatus that explains references to current events and cryptic Kabbalistic riddles and things like that. All this sort of stuff gets explained in the endnotes, as well as noting significant alterations and edits to the manuscript that Crowley made. And so I'll indicate there are lines that were deleted and never printed and things like that, or things that were changed before he went to press, that people can finally see some of the how the sausage was made, as it were.
fascinating.
Yeah, and then the other project I'm working on is, again, Crowley related, looking at his time with the secularist movement in the UK. And this is, going back to where we started, why I think that Crowley chatting with Nietzsche and Bertrand Russell might have been kind of neat, because the secularist movement was trying to take religion out of civic life and make policy decisions and other decisions about how we in a society act based on evidence and scientific principles rather than on faith and religion. And it's through this movement that Crowley gained a lot of his ideas that influenced his own thinking about scientific illuminism and the idea that magic is the method of science and the aim of religion. But it's also the way that he met Victor Newberg, with whom he did that Enochian working, and also J.F.C. Fuller, the military strategist. And the three of these people kind of became the foundation of Thelema going forward. And so it kind of tells the story about how they came together and how the ideas from the secularist movement influenced what they did.
Wow.
So again, one of these deep dives into like a real specific sort of thing. And then after that, I think I'm going to work on some stuff that has a little bit more of a broader appeal. These last two books are really like laser focused, and I'm kind of eager to put those things aside and kind of tackle some new subjects.
Okay, that sounds great. Okay, Richard Kaczynski, thanks very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.